I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody. Welcome to Talking Simpsons, where it gets worse before it gets better. I am your host, the already dead Bob Mackey, and this is the Laser Time Podcast Network's chronological exploration of The Simpsons. Who else is here with me today?
Henry Gilbert and Camus can do, but Sartre is smartra.
Oh, very intelligent.
Another crappy crossover, Chris Antista.
And special guest, Talking Critics.
Dana Goodman. Now let's get silly.
Oh, boy. We're all in front of brick walls right now. We all have machine guns, so
it's
watch
great.
Out.
I like it when a show comes up that's the basis for one of our sound effects.
Yes, yes. By the way, today's episode is A Star Is Burns.
Coming, Eudora.
And it's not a Simpsons burp.
No, that is a Maurice LaMarche burp.
Crossover belch.
Yeah, he also Wacko's burp. And this episode aired on March 5th, 1995. And as always, Chris will tell us what happened on this day in history.
Hot damn, Bobby. An episode of the Jenny Jones Show entitled Same-Sex Crushes is taped but pulled from the air after it results in a real-life murder. Oh. The Super Nintendo tips the scales with its largest video game to date at 32 megabytes with Squaresoft's Chrono Trigger, and a cute little monkey introduces the world to E1101 in the virus movie Outbreak.
Oh, wow, yes. Yeah. That's when Marcel the monkey from Friends infected everybody.
Is that the same monkey?
It is the same monkey.
It's he kills Kevin Spacey.
Good.
Lucky monkey.
Well, see, the monkey shines monkey.
That I don't know.
Oh, robot.
I just remember Marcel stopped being the monkey. He leaves in like the first season and then comes back for the Super Bowl special on Friends where Jean-Claude Van Damme is a guest star and he's in a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. Based on him actually leaving to be in the Dustin Hoffman movie.
I bet he slept with all the friends.
Having to shoot around Marcel. Jesus Christ.
I think that's why they wrote him off. They're like, look, this monkey's funny and all, but it's caused a lot of problems.
We're out of monkey jokes, too. Yeah, today's episode is a very controversial one.
Very.
And I immediately thought of this when I was watching the intro. Like, something looks wrong. Oh, right, Matt Groening's name is on the TV. Oh, right, he took his name off of this episode. Oh,
yes.
Right, and it's a very long and complicated tale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's get into that complicated tale as the critic, a show we already did a couple episodes for on the free feed here, and you can listen to us do all of with Diana Goodman and Michael Raparez on the Patreon. It was a show created by Al Jean and Mike Reese with James L. Brooks after leaving The Simpsons at the end of season 4. It had a very rocky time on ABC, canceled in 6 episodes. Mm-hmm. But they were able to get financing for a second season at Fox. Part of that financing, though, came with that it was going to be cheaper. It would be only 10 episodes instead of even 13. And one of those episodes would be a clip show. And lastly, that the critic team would create 2 episodes of The Simpsons in season 6, mm-hmm. thus to make a 26-episode season instead of a 24-episode season.
And that was really to satisfy the network because they wanted more clip shows and they didn't want to do clip shows to tarnish the reputation of the show.
So the creators, the David Merkin refused to do more clip shows. He also said, we can barely keep up this level of quality doing 23 original episodes a season. So then they're like, fine, season 6 will have 1 clip show and then 2 critic-run episodes, which is this and Round Springfield is the other one produced by the critic team in season 6. Mm-hmm. This one is so much more obvious, though, because it was meant to be a crossover with the critic to, advertise that the critic is going to be debuting next to The Simpsons.
We had to plug a Laser Time show. We did a show, I think, with one of you about backdoor pilots. And this isn't a backdoor pilot, but it is sneaky.
It really is. I mean, this aired on the same night as the first episode of the second season of The Critic. So it was this and then that episode
of The
Critic.
So I would say like millions of viewers, they were discovering Jay Sherman for the first time through The Simpsons. But, you know, this is something in an internet-free world with no Instagram promotions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you had to do to like launch a show, introduce them in a more popular show, and tell them they're going over to here at Wisconsin where we're on every Monday night.
TGIF did it all the time. Mm-hmm. As Lisa Wooden tell, some people thought that was good, like James L. Brooks, Al Jean, and Mike Reese. Some people, like Matt Groening and many of the staff writers on The Simpsons, did not think it was a good idea. And in fact, really didn't like it. Matt Groening, behind the scenes, was fighting it all the way, saying, we really shouldn't do this, we really shouldn't do this. He advised all these rewrites on it just to make Jay work better in the world of The Simpsons. But he was still fighting him on it. And then on March 3rd, this episode aired March 5th, on March 3rd of 1995, Matt Groening goes public to the LA Times. Ooh. And he says he did not want this episode and He explained that he was taking his name off it intentionally because this did not do what he wanted it, the show to be.
I feel like he's going a little crazy here.
So here are some of the quotes from
it. A little extreme compared to the content of the episode. Mm-hmm.
So he says, saying fans will, quote, accuse us of making the crossover episode just to advertise The Critic. That's why I've had my name removed from the episode. Then James L. Brooks and Al Jean and Mike Reiss had some strong words back for him in the article.
Whoa.
James L. Brooks says, quote, I am furious with Matt. He's been going to everybody who wears a suit at Fox and complaining about this. When he voiced his concerns about how to draw The Critic into the Simpsons universe, he was right and we agreed to his changes. Certainly he's allowed his opinion, but airing this publicly in the press is going too far. This has been my worst fear, ellipses. The Matt we know privately is going public. He is a gifted, adorable, cuddly ingrate, but his behavior right now is rotten, and it's not pretty when a rich man acts like this.
Oh boy.
But because that's what, to me, it feels like. It feels like James L. Brooks pulled a power move on Groening. He overruled him.
It's like, this is my show, and these are both my shows.
And I would bet that never happened before.
It probably never had to that extent, and this is what Al Jean had to say. What bothers me about all of this is that now people may get the impression that this Simpsons episode is less than good. It stands on its own, even if The Critic never existed. We never tried to give Matt blame or credit for our show, but it's not like we're some outsiders who suddenly came in and did this thing. We've been with The Simpsons since 1989. Mike and I weren't trying to shove anything down anybody's throats. It was Jim's idea to do the crossover.
Because if this had to happen, this is the most ideal way in the universe that could possibly happen. The original writers come on who know the tone of the show, don't be coached. I like, without being able to watch them back to back, I remember how jarring it was when the DVDs came out. Like, holy shit, Jay Sherman was Simpsonified.
Yes.
They made him look like a different character. So I think I didn't watch this live, but that had to be jarring. Like, this is the same character from before.
I mean,
a little different.
I think Groening did overreact, but I think it was that overreaction that made this episode good. All of his reservations about how to integrate The Critic in the show, I think, worked, because he doesn't overpower the show, he doesn't like dominate the show, and I think this does feel like a Simpsons episode and not a Critic episode. The Simpsons happen to be like in the background.
I would only argue also in Groening's, there's a couple of
clunkers. About 10% of this that I'm like, this is a Critic joke.
It shows how the Critic jokes don't work in Springfield.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. You can't just have celebrities pop out of nowhere in the Simpsons universe. That feels
it's
wrong.
It's true, like having William Shatner suddenly appear to do a one-line joke.
Or Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter. Like, that's such a Critic joke that doesn't, this doesn't happen in Springfield. It's not only is it not a bad episode, we have to come up with a term for it. This launched like 11,000 memes.
People love this episode.
It's so meme-heavy. Yeah. It's very, very meme-heavy. And I want to talk about the writer of this episode, do you have more?
Well, just the other extra seasoning to this I wanted to mention was that in our second interview with Bill Oakley, we asked him about this too, and he said that the LA Times article from 95 covers it pretty well, but he made it sound like most of the writers were on Matt's side, that they're like, this is kind of a crummy thing that makes The Simpsons less special by doing this kind of thing. He said that they had turned down working with, I'm not putting words in Bill Oakley's mouth, listen to the interview yourselves, guys, but he talked about how that Planet Hollywood had said, hey, we could do a guest star on the show, and then they turned it down because, like, why should we do this with Planet Hollywood? So it was seen as like kind of a compromising of The Simpsons' integrity internally.
I could see how they would think, you know, this is a cheap idea and it's usually done really badly.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
As opposed to, well, let's see if there's a way to do it not badly. And I think they totally accomplished that.
Admirably done.
And Bill Oakley said that he felt in the end they probably took it too seriously and they were too strident in their views, which they usually were in the Simpsons writers' room.
The amount of compromising and gimmicks that would occur throughout the next 25 seasons, like, this was not that big a deal.
And none of this ugliness is on the commentary, by the way.
Really?
They actually start the commentary by saying, I'm positively delighted to be here. I'm positive about this. You can tell very much they were told beforehand, this is a positive commentary. We're not going to talk about the bad things.
John Lovitz is there, but Matt Groening isn't there.
Nope.
I can see why Matt Groening would think this is not a great episode. Because there is a couple of, I don't know, real weird things and bombs.
His name is on some lesser episodes.
Yeah, Jesus, there's like 11,000 worse episodes at this point.
I don't think they would know. They didn't know at this point the show had gone on for 20-plus more years, though.
But a crossover is fun for most viewers. And they did it with Family Guy in a way that, like, Simpsons fans should be really mad.
Yeah,
at that.
I hated that way more than this.
Vile.
But I, yeah, as a kid, I just loved this. I was like, I knew the Flintstones and the Jetsons, so I like this too. I was like, yeah, my favorite cartoons are hanging out with each other.
Yeah, and it wouldn't take much of a rewrite to make this not the critic. Mm-hmm. It could just be any character, or you could even not have a critic character come in.
Yeah,
yeah, and also,
and you'd still have a real good episode, man.
John Lovitz has played three guest characters before. This is not unprecedented for John Lovitz to play a new weirdo.
It could have been Artie Ziff.
Yeah, it could have been Artie Ziff. It could have been Llewellyn Sinclair.
They basically did this plot again with Artie Ziff moving in with Homer.
That's true. So now I want to talk about the writer of this episode.
Yes.
His name has come up a lot on The Critic. You might know him best from Futurama, but his name is Ken Keeler.
Yay.
And he is probably the most educated sitcom writer on the planet. I mean, Futurama had four PhDs, but as far as The Simpsons go, this guy has an MA in electrical engineering from Stanford and a PhD in applied mathematics from Harvard. But then he went on to write for David Letterman.
Yes.
He wrote one episode of Wings, and then went on to The Critic, then The Simpsons, then Futurama.
Wow.
And he for some reason, was assigned the most controversial Simpsons episodes. Like, he wrote this one. He wrote Two Bad Neighbors, which was a very controversial, and some people thought one of the worst episodes ever.
Rubbed me the wrong way at the time.
And he wrote The Principal and the Pauper, which we'll get to, and I feel like
in the end,
are you sure?
In the end, that episode is funny, and it's not as bad as you think it is. But, I mean, Ken Keeler is great, and he's really great on commentaries. He's probably the nerdiest guy on any Simpsons or Futurama commentary, which is a high bar to jump over.
Yes, a compliment.
Doctorate in applied mathematics.
Yes.
I like on
what is the formula to getting on The Simpsons from Harvard?
Jesus. I mean, that's into like the level of math that makes you start to like lose your mind.
Yes, it's like numbers aren't even real anymore. And this guy, there is actually a differential calculus joke in this episode, and he had to put that in this episode.
Yes.
It's one of those things in the background of Futurama. It's like, I'm smart, I get that.
Yeah, on the Futurama commentaries, he's even correcting, like, David X. Cohen. I'm like, David X. Cohen will say, well, it's based on this principle. And then Keeler will be like, actually, no. It's the differentiation of that principle. Like, and then Cohen has to be like, oh, damn. Like, but this was how Keeler kind of got into the Simpsons world. This was his backdoor into it, writing for Critic. Mm-hmm. Then he writes this episode of The Simpsons. He will be staff on season 7 and 8 of The Simpsons. And then follow Cohen and Groening to Futurama.
And he wrote a lot of the songs from this era onwards for some reason. I guess maybe the math degree helps you become a better musician.
Times
I don't know.
All these fucking Harvard dudes. Harvard protecting Harvard, man. But and this episode was directed by Susie Dieter, again, already experienced on Simpsons and Critic. Mm-hmm. She had left Simpsons for The Critic in season 6 and now has come crawling back to
this.
This
is a great looking episode, too. She's got to do a lot in this episode. Including that whole Barney thing coming up is just amazing.
Holy God, yeah. Susie Dieter, underrated master director on the show.
She had to mimic David Lean. As a TV animator. Holy shit.
Well, this episode opens with an Al Jean and Mike Reese staple.
Holy
reusing
shit,
animation.
Yep. We get the long, long version of Ion Springfield with some very distracting season 2 animation among season 6
It's
animation.
Actually from season 3's Flaming Moe's. But there's like a new arrangement of the theme, which sounds worse. They just make it longer.
But first, we all stink.
We all... Hey!
According to a national survey ranking, Springfield is the least popular city in America. In science, dead last. I'm telling you people, the Earth revolves around the sun.
Burn him!
What a story!
You've stolen my soul!
In culture, dead last.
Eleanor, we've got to do something about this depression. So I propose... Oh, that's right, I'm crippled.
I love how Garber says,
So will.
Almost like sex.
So, does anyone want to guess what America's most unpopular city is right now?
What is it?
It's got to be something in Ohio.
Youngstown, Ohio, my birthplace. St. Louis.
Detroit.
Detroit. According to USA Today, Detroit's the worst city in America because it has a poverty rate of 39.8.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I want to say my hometown beats it, but I don't know offhand.
Youngstown does suck.
It's bad.
Youngstown's not this close to being Mad Max.
It's true. You can drink some of our water.
I wonder how Skinner avoided being burned alive at the stake.
Yes.
But that they are literally lynching people in Springfield still, apparently.
For the heliocentric model. We've got to stop that.
And Sunrise at Campo Bello is a real thing, by the way. It was a 1958 play and 1960 film about the FDR is stricken with polio right before he is going to be nominated as the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. inundate.
That could not have been a real line from the player movie. It's so on the nose. No. You have to do something about this depression.
I would say that the Eleanor, takes 2 hours that's to get a pretty foxy looking Eleanor Roosevelt.
I know, she's got some hips, that Eleanor. I didn't have it in there, but there was also the rapping rabbis joke.
My time to shine. Okay. My dad's humor, which was thoroughly influenced by NPR. NPR thought this was the funniest thing in the world, and I've looked it up several times to do like a parody song episode of Laser Time. This has no fans. Two Live Jews was a group of Jews, two Jewish guys who making fun of Two Live Crew, starting with their 1990 album As Kosher As They Want to Be.
Wow.
They had 5 albums, including one Christmas album.
Of course.
And their Wikipedia is filled with red links with no citations. But my dad, he never listened to them, but he told me about them all the time because he thought it was the most hilarious concept in the universe because we're from Florida and Two Live Crew was on everybody's lips. I have a clip over there of the awful song that's parodying Me So Horny. It's I think it's called Oh It's So Humid.
Walking back to the hotel from the bagel shop. It was so damn humid, air was on us like a mop. I was shredding like a mule, I was frying like a blintz. I was swimming in my shorts, if you get the hint.
Oh, it's so humid. Oh, it's so
humid.
Oh,
wait.
So.
This became Oh Hello, right?
That is. Oh.
But yeah, it's probably
much better.
Why did he say sweat and not schwitz?
Schwitz.
What's
schwitz.
Happening?
So, Diana, there's a whole 2 other minutes you didn't hear.
This is a mix of Two Live Jews and the Benedictine Monks.
I just can't believe this exists.
I forgot about
this. And there was because in my record store, there was a comedy album section, which I'd always go through because George Carlin and Weird Al albums were rare. Like, I know there's a Weird Al album from 1986, and I've never seen it. So I go, and they had their own section in the comedy section. And it was the first one because of the two. Two Live Jews were always the head of the comedy section. And they've resonated for years and remained popular.
They say it out loud in the episode that this is also inspired by the Benedictine Monks, which... People get mad at me on The Critic sometimes where I say, this is a Simpsons joke done again, or The Simpsons would later redo this joke. Mm-hmm. On the same night, they do the same joke. In the season premiere of Critic, they also do a Benedictine Monk joke in it. It's like,
no, but it's just parallel thought.
It's the same writing group in an episode that airs the same night. Nice.
But Pretty Woman is so bodacious, just like St. Ignatius.
There was one before that, too. This is like the third time in a row they've done this joke. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
It's such an easy joke because it was such a weird thing to be popular. There was a recording of Benedictine Monks.
It went platinum or something.
Like platinum several times. It was a huge worldwide hit. Chant.
It was just chanting. Chant. Yeah, it really inspired Gina Reese. It also lets you know that once Reese is back, they do a lot more of Jew. They do many more Jewish jokes than had been happening in this season.
It was at the time it was a huge phenomenon because it rose to number one on the charts, stayed there for weeks, and had no radio play and no play on MTV, not even the Country Music Channel. It was just albums, like white people buying albums. That's the only reason it sold so well.
This will make me smart if I listen to it.
It's relaxing to have on in the background, I guess. You know, you can get busy to it and think about all those monks and how they can't have sex now, but I am. Yeah, it's like a weird cuckolding thing. I'm cuckolding all the monks right now.
They're the original cucks.
This pretty much gets lost after this point, but the reason they're doing a film festival is because they want Springfield to be bettered and not be the worst city in America, but it's never mentioned again after this, but that it will ruin the tourist trade. And I include this just because I got some expert opinion on how Bart talks here.
I think we should call a town meeting. If we don't do something soon, we won't get any tourists at all.
No tourists? I'll be ruined. Maps to movie stars, homes! Maps para las casas de los cineastas!
Excuse me, are you Drew Barrymore?
What? Get out of here. I'm hungover.
Sorry, Miss Barrymore.
What?
I do like most. What?
What?
It should be more to that joke, I suppose.
That's, but, a very Critic joke to me for some
reason. Yeah, like Japanese tourist jokes feel like more of a Critic thing than a Simpsons thing.
Though, so Bart is speaking Japanese there. So he says, maps to movie stars home, then maps to cineasta, which is Spanish.
Las casas cineastas.
And then, in what sounds like Nancy Cartwright saying phonetic Japanese, says, tapusta no Chizumapu, which I thought I knew what it meant, but I made sure to check with friend of the show, Bongo comics artist, and person who speaks Japanese, Nina Matsumoto, and she confirmed to me that what Bart says is map of top stars. So Tapu stars, that's top stars.
Map.
No of, though you kind of have to reposition it. And then Chizu is map, but Mapu is also map. One is the traditional Japanese word for map. One is their borrowed word for map of Mapu.
Mapu.
So basically says map. Mm. But it's technically ish correct.
They did some research.
They
seems.
Did.
Yeah.
They,
that's
they,
nice. Though, he's not just yelling gibberish like, ha, Asian voices are funny. Yeah.
Though she said she had never noticed that was Japanese before, partially because it is like really mangled. But again, it's like, I would bet Nancy Cartwright was just handed phonetic words and just said them.
Can I get into a nerdy detail that I never noticed before? Mm-hmm. Bart says, I'll be ruined, and we get a harp noise to signify an imaginary sequence.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, that is more of the cause for an imaginary
one. Yeah, it's not a cutaway. Mm. It's in his brain, but yet we see Mo.
Yeah, that's
true. His fantasy ends with like a Mo prank.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Yeah, obviously, if you were going to sell maps to the stars, there's only two stars, maybe three, in all of Springfield. So obviously, it's just going to use it as an excuse to harass Mo a bunch.
I bet all the addresses are Mo. That's
oh, that's great. That's the prank calls extending in another meeting.
Exactly. Yeah, you can't prank him anymore. Okay, we figured it out. This joke is deeper than we thought.
Yeah, though that's right. This is again makes it more like Gene and Reese. They start by watching TV, a Gene and Reese favorite. And way more cutaway to jokes than you got in these American episodes that we've been commenting
Although,
on.
You said this is 95?
March 95.
March 95. So Drew Barrymore had cleaned up her act by then.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah.
She was about to do Boys on the Side.
Love. I remember that movie. Mm-hmm.
existed.
has she flashed David Letterman by this point?
Right around, somewhere in that time. Yeah.
She had done Playboy by this point.
She cameoed in Wayne's World 2.
Mm. Yeah. But
Bjergen of the Bjergen Fjords.
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, but she, you know, she was off the drugs and the booze by then. They cleaned herself up.
The Simpsons will be right back.
Hey, this is Sideshow Luke Perry. You're listening to Talking Simpsons on Laser Time.
Then also that shows this episode kind of is a traditional Simpsons episode. They go straight to a town meeting.
Yeah.
And that Seinfeld joke just sucks, honestly.
It's bad, but it also made me wonder that this is probably the one Seinfeld joke the show ever made. And Seinfeld was the hugest show that started when The Simpsons started.
That's what I looked into. Because I love it when The Simpsons is the biggest phenomenon I remember happening when it happened. Mm-hmm. And I've lived so long, and so was The Simpsons. It was awesome early on to see the show honor other phenomenons, like Ren and Stimpy, or Jurassic Park. Like, oh, shit, I get this. The Seinfeld, I think it's only interesting that it had been on... This is in its fifth season.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But it was not a huge hit. The first three seasons got shit ratings. No one was talking about it. The critics liked it. And what was the tale
the
that...
The episode, I think, was the...
But it's in the production order, because you would date this back to around 1994.
Yeah.
That's the fourth season when not only did Seinfeld shoot up, it remained in the top two. The top two or three until for the next 5 years. So it's having to acknowledge the one show everybody's talking about more than The Simpsons. And at this time, it's Seinfeld.
It was the non-drama water cooler show. Yeah. Like, can you believe what happened?
Yes, because ER, you could say the same thing about, but who the fuck cares about ER? But
though also, you know, The Critic made fun of Seinfeld before in the first episode of The Critic.
This is how people actually talk.
How people talk, Dan.
Yeah.
Which... That's ripe for The Critic to do, which is like, well, Critic, you're not realistic either. Like, are you saying you're helping?
Yeah, I'd never seen The Simpsons poke fun at a sitcom other than like Cosby, which it was always kind of had a rivalry with, being on the same at the same time and the same night.
I was trying to remember when they made fun of Friends, and I think it was only in, again, another Gene and Reese episode, Simpson Tide. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, what's in David Schwimmer? Oh, he is kind of handsome in an ugly way.
Well, that's right. Actually, I think it's more of an acknowledgement and not a jab, because I think everyone on the staff likes Seinfeld.
Yeah, yeah.
They talked about Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein. They wrote Seinfeld spec scripts to get on The Simpsons.
Yeah, I think
writers would go from The Simpsons right to Seinfeld, like Jennifer Crittenden. So
I'm speculating, but not unlike Ren and Stimpy, I think it was a tip of the hat to another white hot phenomenon that they were acknowledging. It
was more like just a nerdy idea of like, well, Springfield is only a few letters off from Seinfeld.
But it's also not a joke.
It is not really a joke. Not very funny.
Not really.
The next joke is much funnier.
Yeah.
I may be just a boy, but I have an idea. If I may, I'd like to show you a few slides. Here's Springfield as it appears from space. Somewhere in this windy valley is the Lost Dutchman's mine.
Young man, that appears to be a picture of your rear end.
So long, suckers! This is the last time I use an escape plan devised by Milhouse. Sorry, Bart.
I want to think they're just rolled up in that for the rest of the meeting. Yes, just watching the rest of the meeting.
The whole time. I think that's a great pointless prank of Bart's of just like, I'm going to show everybody my butt and just talk about it farting. That's his entire
Lost Dutchman's mind.
It is also classic. Bart likes taking photos of his butt.
It's true.
It's something he does quite a lot.
And you can write on his butt very legibly.
It's my Twitter cover photo for several years.
I remember
years.
That. Yeah, I think it still is.
It still is. Lord knows I'm not updating that site.
And then also I'm kind of a double up of the gambling episode as well. Marge has a good idea, but everybody doubts her at first. Mm-hmm. But
I love the one guy. Marge is going to say something.
Marge is going to say something. Dan is on fire in this episode. As we find out, Dan's on the commentary, and they point out multiple times, like especially in one big moment I'll bring up later, Dan's ad-libbing really helped them out on the show. He's kind of almost a writer, really. They depend a lot on Dan Castellaneta.
Now, I know you haven't liked some of my past suggestions, like switching to the metric system.
The metric system is the tool of the devil. My car gets 40 rods to the hog's head, and that's the way I like it.
The old person's remarks will be stricken from the record.
Who said that?
My new idea is different. I think we should hold a film festival and give out prizes.
So
I did the math on this.
I did the math too, but the problem is Hogshead is inconsistent.
It is.
It's different.
It's a measure of depth, not distance.
No, it's
sorry,
it's
I'm doing an SNL sketch here.
No, I mean it's
we'll talk about leagues.
Good old 20,000 leagues.
Yeah. No, I mean it's a measure of volume, but for wine, it's one thing. For beer, it's another. For tobacco, it's another. It
Hogshead.
Hogshead. Yeah.
So they didn't just make it up. It is a real oldie time.
Rod is a distance of measurement, and hogshead is a distance of is a kind of volume. Yeah.
Okay, wow. So you wouldn't measure a distance into a volume then.
Well, no, if you're doing miles per gallon, yes.
Oh,
you are.
Okay.
So, all right, what did your math come up with?
My math came out to 660 feet for 63 gallons of gas.
That's the same math I had.
So wow. Not fuel efficient at all. So 0.125 miles for 63 gallons of gas.
Yeah.
Boy.
0.002 miles per gallon, which is three times as bad as the M1 Abrams tank.
Oh, my God. What is Grandpa driving?
I don't know.
Stolen tank.
I was confused because
it's a tank with shitty mileage.
I was confused because I give out rods on my popular YouTube series Top 5 Vapes, and that's how I score. This frog is 7 rods. 7 or 19
rods. To my hog's head.
Someday I'll meet that 19 rod babes. Like, comment, and subscribe.
I had always thought he'd made that up. I did not know Hogshead was a real thing.
I read a lot of old-timey books. So.
Wow. I whenever I think of America's crappy measurement system compared to metric, I think of that. I think of the Hogshead.
Yep.
And then it does.
A real thing.
We really should be on metric. It's bad. I mean, we're no better than stone. Like, at least we don't measure things in stone.
Grandpa doesn't know you're not supposed to drive an H all the time. There's hills to accommodate for.
That's why his mileage is so bad.
How many liters of kerosene do you think it takes?
Gene and Reese were really into the idea of Wiggum cross-dressing, by the way, too. They got a lot of jokes out of that, like an excuse to wear makeup. Did anybody else think Bart's introduction to the eternal struggle? On the commentary, they say it's supposed to be Criswell from Plan 9. But it now reminds me as Proto Bam Margera. It is a guy talking to the camera saying, I'm about to prank my dad, and then shows his fat dad
and
makes fun of him.
Welcome to Jackass.
I feel like this could have slightly inspired the Bam Margera delivery.
I mean, I felt like it wasn't quite Rod Serling, but I see them that they were trying to go for Criswell. But Criswell, you need bigger.
Yeah.
Like a desk.
I predict.
It's where we're all going to live.
Colonize Mars by 1954.
But his hair is a bit more like that, though, I would say.
Well, please watch it.
I love that movie. And then also we get to see the Flanders to God scene, which is pretty cute.
They shrink Todd down to baby size for this to work. Mod is cradling Todd like a very small version of Todd.
True. He's
no boy would float that fast.
And we see God's five-fingered hand.
It literally is God saving Ned Flanders' child, which is a pretty outward move for God.
So I would never complain about this episode, but in the middle of this season, it feels a hell of a lot like the Simpsons movie. Like it hits certain beats, like the town hall opening with television, like all of Springfield getting together and going over the top with jokes like this. And I mean, these guys would eventually come up back aboard and write the Simpsons. It just feels like people who are coming on board, like, I know the beats of this show. Yeah. I got this. I can do whatever I'd like.
It's somebody resuming something they used to do instead of being... They're getting back on the bicycle after a while instead of...
Yeah, I don't mean that as an insult at all. It's just there's a lot of high points or like seeing God, for instance, like outside of a dream sequence is something I don't think any other episode would do.
It's like it's nothing who literally saves Ned, his child through prayer.
When God intervened in Mr. Plow, we didn't see him. He just went, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Though it seemed like they heard him, but... yes, then we get the introduction of Jay into the world of The Simpsons.
I have to say one thing. I mean, they try to find a film critic, and they say there's 600 film critics, and Leonard Maltin's the most attractive.
True.
That is true.
It's true.
Never trust an attractive film critic.
No way.
Never.
So you didn't like Roper very much.
No,
Richard
I don't
Roper
trust
is
him.
A handsome dude,
I don't trust him as someone who actually spends time not sitting on their ass.
So then, so then Harry Knowles is the best film critic.
Exactly. Obviously.
By that metric.
Exactly. By that metric, Jabba the Hutt is R.I.P. the best film critic.
I would say that at that time, I thought Gene Siskel was more attractive than Leonard Maltin.
Nah, Gene Shalit, bro. All the way. All the way.
You get lost in that hair.
What you doing, Ma?
I'm looking for a film critic to help judge our festival. Did you know there are over 600 critics on TV, and Leonard Maltin is the best looking of them all?
Ew.
Welcome to Coming Attractions. I'm your host, Jay Sherman. Thank you. Tonight, we review an aging Charles Bronson in Death Wish 9.
I wish I was dead.
I fucking hate that joke.
For the first time, Charles Bronson's voice is used on Charles Bronson.
Yeah, you're right, Chris. That was like cut from Mad Magazine.
I hate that joke.
You can't use this panel.
And that film series had ended like almost a decade
Death Wish
earlier.
5 had come out 5 years
before
earlier.
Bruce Willis made it relevant again.
Oh, no.
Troubled Times.
I can't wait to see him murder black people on the street. It's going to be really great.
That movie series.
Especially by Eli Roth. It's a very
toxic
racist.
By
oh
every fucking stretch of the imagination.
Talk about sexual harassment in the film industry is big now. If you watch that Electric Boogaloo film, it is Death Wish is filmed crimes against women. Like, that's what it is.
You should, while watching the series back to back, be sure to drink every time Charles Bronson's daughter is raped to justify a mass vigilante killing spree.
A horrible, yes, and then it's
and
really...
she doesn't get to go on the spree. It's not none of the I spit on your grave Ms. 45 shit there.
They all get murdered. Like, they all, they first
no,
they
no,
are
she's catatonic after the first one.
Sometimes, though, they get murdered or just assaulted.
At some point, she is murdered.
But also, in the films, it's really just an excuse for him to shoot black
do
people
whatever
in the back. Like, it's wish fulfillment to be like,
Jimmy Carter's not doing nothing.
I'm an angry old man. I wish I could shoot these these urban kids in the streets.
We just covered one of 30-20-10 where like he's like Rambo called back to do it again.
Did this inspire Bernie Getz, or was this post-Bernie
Getz? It
was
post-Bernie Getz.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, that's why the film series is pretty fucking toxic. It comes from a different era to justify vigilante justice.
Well, Bernie Getz is also a racist dude.
On petty crime. And petty crime.
But it was just a dude who murders people. Yeah. And like, Death Wish 3 is fun if you can disassociate yourself from the crimes you're witnessing happening behind the scenes. It is entertaining in how crazy it is.
If you think a guy stealing your tape player from your car deserves to be decapitated for his crime, it's a great movie for you.
There's a great scene where he buys a camera like, well, I know this camera will be stolen from me within seconds by the many hoodlums here. Oh, he did it. Cool, that's all the excuse I need. Giant Desert Eagle shoots him in the back, and everybody applauds him murdering someone in the street.
Yeah, I mean, at least Crocodile Dundee would play a fun knife game with the criminal.
Yeah,
and
knifey knife.
Not hurt him.
And again, that had to inspire so many real-life murders of people who thought, like, well, I'm Charles Bronson right here.
I think it inspired open carry.
Yes! But so, yes, Death Wish 5 was the last one, and
Bronson
would not get his own Death Wish until 7 years after episode aired. He would die in 2002. He wasn't in good health. He had retired from acting by this point from poor health, but he was technically still alive, if you call that living. And Jay's redesign is kind of in between... He's kind of in between season 1 and season 2, Jay. Season 2, Jay, they say on the commentary, he's a smurf, basically.
Yeah.
But
And that's why it was so weird, because the critic season one and two designs are slightly different.
Very different.
They're very different. Like, yeah. Actually, every character is different.
I didn't have it. Yeah. I didn't have them on tape, so like, I hadn't seen the critic in a few months, and you see him on The Simpsons, like, this is just what he looks like, I think.
Yeah, well, they had to give him the overbite. He doesn't have an overbite in the show.
Like any other celebrity guest would get.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's too bad they didn't include any of his other co-stars in The Critic, but I guess... I get that they're like, it's hard enough to introduce Jay Sherman into the show if we added Duke or Doris or...
What if Duke and Burns had a scene together? That'd be amazing. Charles Napier and...
It would have been great, yes.
I would say there's one other character from The Critic in here, because as I always say on the Talking Critic podcast, the fifth character is really the score.
Yes.
But in all
the city.
In all seriousness, like the clarinet, the woodwinds of The Critic come in this episode quite a bit.
I give huge thumbs up to Alf Clausen and his team capturing the Hans Zimmery score and the feel of the Gershwin feel of the Critic soundtrack.
The riff on Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah. Totally.
It plays on the streets of New York.
But it's very fitting that he meets Rainier Wolfcastle like that. This was the smartest use of it. Yeah.
So Arnold Schwarzenegger is real in the Critic universe, but also in Springfield, there's a character named Rainier Wolfcastle.
Well,
or no, in this version of New York, in the Simpsons version of New York, Rainier Wolfcastle is
goes
real.
Goes to New York. Yeah, yeah, well, so I want to dig more into this is that this is an alternate universe, Jay, because in the world of The Critic, Simpsons is a TV show
people
watch on TV. Jay dresses up as Homer at a Halloween party.
He lives
in a world where the Simpsons exist. So this is the Simpsons Dimensions Jay Sherman.
Oh, my God.
Not the Jay Sherman who's on The Critic.
Right now, I'm on Matt Groening's side. This is problematic.
This Jay Sherman does not... The Jay Sherman we see on The Critic does not remember going here because this is that universe's Critic.
Or maybe that universe's Jay Sherman agreed to be on The Simpsons as a guest star because he's a very famous critic.
Oh, and so this episode aired within that world.
Yes.
Okay, wow, that's even better. You get the no prize.
My brain hurts.
Thank you.
But this is pretty great.
But first, we have a special guest, Rainier Wolfcastle, star of the reprehensible McBain movie.
Jay, my new film is a mix of action and comedy. It's called McBain, Let's Get Silly. Did you ever notice how men always leave the toilet seat up? That's the joke.
You suck, McBain!
Now, my Woody Allen impression. I'm a neurotic nerd who likes to sleep with little girls.
Hey, that really sucked!
The film is just me in front of a brick wall for an hour and a half. It cost $80 million.
How do you sleep at night?
On top of a pile of money with many beautiful ladies.
Just asking.
There's at least two memes buried in that clip.
Oh, first off, that's the joke, which is our line. It feels... Should we just give this line to the show just because it's the quote?
I think it has to be.
That's the joke.
Yes. That is the joke. I've seen that meme. Somebody, I just saw that happen with Bill Corbett of MST3K. He did a joke on Twitter. Somebody replied to it like, actually, that would be unfeasible if that were to happen. And then he replied with that's the joke.
I'll tell you what, there are lots of bad people on Twitter. The worst people, some of the worst people next to Nazis are the joke police. They're like, your joke doesn't work. I have one way your joke wouldn't work.
Yeah. Actually, this technically wouldn't. So that's the joke is used all the time.
Besides, you know, the pile of money and the many beautiful women.
That too, yeah.
As obviously being the other joke. Anytime the critic shows up means we got to make fun of Woody Allen.
No matter what. Yeah, that doesn't...
I love it.
Because the best Woody Allen joke is on the Simpsons. I like those Woody Allen movies, except for that nervous fella. It's the best Woody Allen joke
ever. I think my favorite Simpsons Woody Allen joke is him in Japan saying, like, these crackers will drive you bananas. What did I do to deserve this? Oh, right.
Yeah. That is the best Woody Allen joke.
Well, The Simpsons never got that harsh with a celebrity scandal. Like,
they really didn't like celebrity gags all that much.
Yeah.
This episode has way more named celebrities in it than others.
It steered away from things you might get bummed out by, such as Woody Allen fucking his daughter.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer.
Bit of a bummer unless you're into that Pornhub channel. I don't know, maybe.
That's more of a recent development.
As Space Ghost would say, you're bringing me down, man. But yeah, whenever I think of rich people who don't give a shit about making bad things, I think of on top of a pile of money with many beautiful ladies, which again is like, well, how do you make such garbage? because it makes me rich and then I have sex. Like, I'm very fulfilled in all these ways. Who I don't give a shit about art.
That's why we make these podcasts.
Exactly. All the money and the beautiful is. It was just so fitting that Ramir Wolfcastle would be on the show, even though Jay should ask him, like, well, wait, why aren't you Arnold Schwarzenegger? Like,
Arnold Schwarzenegger exists in the Simpsons universe,
I mean, later he would. He's the president of the Simpsons universe.
Which is a whole other can of worms.
I hate that joke. Yeah. I'd never, had you guys ever heard the term ears are burning before this episode?
I never have. And I will say, I think this might be my favorite Homer one-liner of all time.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Of just stupid Homer getting so stupid in a nice compact joke.
I'm going to play the clip right here.
I like him. He's smart. He's sensitive. He's clearly not obsessed with his physical appearance.
My ears are burning.
I wasn't talking about you, Dad.
No, my ears are really burning. I wanted to see inside, so I lit a Q-tip.
Well, the idea that he had to lit a Q-tip.
Everything about just the logistics of, like, okay, well, obviously, you lean into the mirror. Well, that's not work. Maybe you can do two mirrors.
Yeah, you need a second mirror.
No, it's too dark in there. I need, like, a little torch. Hey, these look like tiny torches. I'll just... light it on fire and then stick it in my ear. Maybe I can see it now.
And then his ear is still smoking.
Was that where his gummy bear was stuck?
Oh,
that's, the one that
could
was
be it. A pimple or a boil.
Neither pimple nor boil. It's gummy bear.
I assume that was like on his back or something. But yes, then Marge opens the door finally to the crossover to begin.
Dear Mr. Sherman, on behalf of the people of Springfield, I would like to invite you to judge our film festival. You can stay with us and enjoy the sights and sounds of the country.
Marge, is this a pimple or a boil?
Just a minute, Homer. Oh, look what you made me write. Anyway, we think you'll really enjoy our quiet little town. Sincerely, Marge Simpson.
Do I really want to leave Manhattan?
Sherman, I just realized you insulted me. Now you will die.
Hey, Nutnik, your shoe's untied.
From here, they appear to be tied, but I will go in for a closer look.
Taxi! To the airport!
On closer inspection, these are loafers.
That was Dan Castellaneta doing that joke that they did in the temp track that then Harry Shearer just phoned in and did his part for it.
Yeah, and we pointed this out on Talking Critic, but this story beat would come up later in The Critic. Jay insults John Paul LaPope's movie, and then John Paul LaPope comes after him.
Yes.
And in this episode, Rainier Wolfcastle comes after Jay.
That will be weeks later in the show, though.
Yeah.
In John Paul LaPope's case, who is a Jean-Claude Van Damme character, he never really wanted to kill Jay. Rainier does want to kill Jay.
In the street.
Yeah. It was a funnier time when the idea of somebody walking down the street with an AK-47 was like, this is funny, not, ooh, this is depressing. It's a very arched line, though, of like, do I really want to leave New York? Like, yeah, you're just asking for a comedy thing to come at you if you say, do I really want to leave New York with an open question like that? I also have said, on closer inspection, a million times when restating an obvious thing.
I'm more fascinated by it. Nudnik. It's just a word Nudnik. I came across in Mad Magazine 8,000 times.
Yep. Good old Yiddish. Yiddish has so many descriptive words for people you don't like.
Mad Magazine like snuck so much Yiddish in the kids' brains. It's great.
Yeah, that was a Jewish conspiracy, sounds like. I can't.
Making me choke down that borscht belt humor every single day.
And that Sergio Aragonés is the...
that Spaniard.
Yeah.
So that airplane landing from New York is it's such a weak joke, too. Again, like, hey, I'm flying here. Like, very funny.
That's what they do in New York.
Yeah.
And graffiti.
It's a very critic joke, which is just like, I feel like Simpsons would have been better than that. And then, yes,
Mookie, you found my trash can.
Yeah, exactly. Same deal. I also love, it's a very visual gag, so I didn't get it, but Homer rewriting Simpsons three times in a row.
Yeah.
I love that. I've done that too, of just like, oh, I know I wrote the wrong thing, but for some reason you keep writing it the wrong way, even though you know it's wrong. And then we find out that it was a gummy bear, not a pimple or a boil, which they didn't have to return to that joke. I kind of like them going back to that joke.
Yeah, so Homer and Homer and Apu has a sucker stuck to him at all times.
Oh,
is it like a reserve gummy bear, too?
I guess so. That one seems to be unintentional.
Yeah.
So then we get the line that this joke was by Al Jean to kind of hang a lantern on the obviousness of the commercial, of the consumer-y reason for this crossover.
Coming up next, the Flintstones meet the Jetsons.
Uh-oh, I smell another cheap cartoon crossover.
Bart Simpson, meet Jay Sherman, the critic.
Hello.
Hey, man, I really love your show. I think all kids should watch it. I suddenly feel so dirty.
It seems like it would have been enough. Like, relax, Matt. There. There, yeah, we acknowledged it.
It was meant to defang it, but I don't think it totally did. Yeah.
It sent me down a spiral of, like, this was not the second cartoon crossover. This actually happened all the time. It happens so often, it's not worth mentioning.
No.
But at that point, fuck yeah, Jetsons Meet the Flintstones was the most popular famous reference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I could get through it as a kid. It should have been.
Dude,
the,
it sucked. I wanted it so
even
bad.
As a child, all I wanted was to like it, and
it's,
I get bored.
It's worse than 1960s Hanna-Barbera animation, but slightly better, but worse in a different way, in a filmation-y kind of way.
Yeah, it's awful. It's a 1987 made-for-TV movie, and clearly Mel Blanc and George O'Hanlon are dying audibly. And you're right, it is so boring, and the plot is awful. Like, Elroy goes back in time, and, you know, shenanigans ensue. And we have a clip here of really... Here's something they meet for the first time.
What are we doing, Fred? They might not even be around anymore.
He's there. He's peeking around from behind a tree.
We have to show it because we
want both heads.
There's two of them, Dad.
Are they young and good looking?
Wrong on both counts.
Let me see.
Holy Kawasaurus. That guy's third head is a girl.
Well, find out if one of those three heads knows how to talk.
Okay. Yabba dabba, friend.
Well, one thing, the people of the future don't waste any words.
Hey, Dad, I think he said friend. Try it.
Oba doba, friend.
Hey, did you recognize that word, Bon?
Which one, oba or doba?
He said friend. Come on, let's take a chance.
Get on with it.
You can hear Mel Blanc's feeding tube.
It's like, they have 90 minutes to pad out with this shit.
But you're with me. Like,
maybe an hour, I don't know, but it's
too
long.
No, it was 2 hours. It was two hours with commercials.
It's 2 hours with commercials. I looked into this too much, because otherwise, why should I even be here? But I loved the Flintstones and Jetsons as a kid, undiscerningly. And
there was a cartoon that was on, and you
this
could
is
watch
a big
it.
Deal.
I watched all of them.
They hadn't crossed over except for one NES game, where the last level is in the Jetsons universe.
Oh, you're right.
The Flintstones
it
Hot
connects
Rescue.
Everything.
It does. But this is even worse. It aired in September of 1987 in syndication, the second of 10 of Hanna-Barbera's Superstars 10 series, which is like this cynical strengthening of Hanna-Barbera shoveling its library everywhere. We'll make it more relevant by making new films. And this is one of the only ones that significantly crossed over. Can you believe this hadn't happened in 25 years?
Especially because of the 70s Hanna-Barbera stuff, they all crossed over.
They all crossed over.
The Laugh Olympics had them all meet each other, but not
Flintstones.
No Flintstones. Yeah. The primetime characters of Flintstones and Jetsons weren't included in that. It was all the morning characters.
Was 87 also the Jetsons movie?
That was 89.
But like, this is significant
to
me.
God awful.
Oh god.
Because I saw the promos, and believe me, I did my work. I tried to look up the promos. The best promo for this is the worst thing you've ever heard in one channel of audio. I don't know why they hired this 16-year-old girl to do the promo. It's disgusting. But I missed it, and you know, like television back in the day, you missed it. It's done, and it came out on video. So I remember every week going to the video store. And it's always gone. It's that popular for like a year. And I finally saw it. Just your reaction, Bob. This is so boring. This is so fucking boring. And I remember wanting just all you had to tell me is that the Flintstones live underneath the Jetsons. Instead, they invent multiple methods of time travel.
Yep, it's time travel. At the end, they're able to go back in time even when the time machine is broken because enough chronotons are in Fred's car, they try to sell to the future.
Through the power of love, maybe?
Kinda, yeah. It's
don't need a credit card to ride this train.
Well, also in that clip, it had the thing that drove me crazy in first viewing of just like, Jetson's...
Sorry. First viewing?
Yeah. Only viewing. Viewing as a kid.
Thank God.
But so George Jetson never had a Yabba Dabba Doo. He didn't have one.
He had a Jane Stop This Crazy Thing.
Yeah, but he didn't have... But they give him Ooba Dooba, and they pretend that he's always said it.
Oh my God.
And so in that scene when he's just like, Ooba Dooba, Yabba Dabba... No, he didn't. You can't just make up a catchphrase for him to say that's equal to
Yabba. He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car.
Yes!
What about leap, oop, ork,
Yeah,
that means I'll do that. I've said it 1,000,000,000,000 times. Hanna-Barbera is the closest animation gets to improv in the universe. It's clearly the first. Every script is a first draft.
So
it's
bad.
Awful.
Well, and it's so sad to think that they were like the A team of animation. Like, boy, I'd rather watch a Hanna-Barbera cartoon than a Filmation one. That's
so the Pac-Man animated series team.
And I was just yelling with a guest slash on Facebook that Warner Brothers eventually bought Hanna-Barbera, and now they have these figures. Get all your favorite Warner Brothers characters. Bugs, Daffy, Porky, Speedy, Quick Draw, Madrigal. I'm like, no, do not taint your brand with these fucking characters. Like, do not make them as irrelevant. Do not make Bugs and Daffy as irrelevant as Hanna-Barbera characters.
Yeah.
End rant. I am so sorry, Simpsons.
Yeah, we are stuck on this. I want to point out one more thing. Bart says, I think all kids should watch it. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. He didn't say, I think everyone should watch it, because Bill Oakley told us adults didn't watch The Simpsons at this era. So
it was a kid show.
And that could account for the softening of the critic. Like, we're going to make this more kid-friendly in a way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Despite having like the only fingering joke I ever heard on television at that point.
The Jetsons didn't get original animation that they starred in again after the movie. So they had Flintstones Meet the Jetsons, then the new series of Jetsons that they made for syndication.
Mm-hmm. That was early 80s. That was before
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And then the movie. And after the movie, there wasn't a new Jetsons solo thing until their crossover with WWE this year.
I knew it.
Give or take a Kanye
what
West video.
Yes, yeah. Well, they do appear in an episode of Harvey Birdman, which is actually pretty funny because they make fun of how totally stupid and useless all of them are.
And how the Jetsons was just one joke.
Yep.
Can we get onto that ogre Mr. Burns?
Yes.
I don't know. Can't we talk more about Hanna-Barbera cartoons?
You talk about it yourself.
I don't know what's happening. It seems our profits have dropped 37%.
I'm afraid we have a bad image, sir. Market research shows people see you as something of an ogre.
Yeah, you ought to club them and eat their bones.
Well, maybe this film festival could help us. A film biography might let them get to know the real you. Virtuous, heroic, nubile.
You left out Pleasant. But I like that film biography idea. A slick Hollywood picture to gloss over my evil rise to power like Bugsy or Working Girl. Get me Steven Spielberg.
He's unavailable.
Then get me his non-union Mexican equivalent. Listen, Señor Spielbergo, I want you to do for me what Spielberg did for Oscar Schindler.
Schindler es bueno. Señor Burns es el diablo.
Listen, Spielbergo, Schindler and I are like peas in a pod. We're both factory owners. We both made shells for the Nazis, but mine worked, damn it. Now go out there and win me that festival.
Oh, man.
That's so I'd only got seen Schindler's List when this episode came out. That is all my line of the show. All of it.
Yeah. I mean, non-union Mexican equivalent is also a meme that
I love all of it.
Club them and eat their bones. And he clubs Smithers in the head, too.
It is strange how the plot changes from Springfield needs to improve its image to Mr. Burns needs to improve his image.
Yes, halfway through, Mr. Burns just shoves himself into it. But
for the better.
They know Mr. Burns makes every script better. And probably they were like thirsty, as writers, they were thirsty for Mr. Burns. They're like, I miss writing Mr. Burns. Even Duke isn't the same.
Yep, he gets a different musical sting than usual. He gets a Darth Vader theme.
He does get the Imperial March.
It's happened before, and that's what reminds me of old people coming back to their show, because the joke happened way earlier on, but less. This is a way more bombastic version.
It's quite. And I like his easy. That he just throws out there, oh yeah, I made bombs for the Nazis, and they worked.
They worked, damn it.
Lots of American industrialists worked with the Nazis before they were officially our enemies.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Do we have
Look
to
up
explain?
Fanta.
Yeah.
There's lots Bayer, of words we could say.
Bayer aspirin. Anyway.
Do we have to
explain the thing from Schindler's List that there's a point where, you know, he's got basically concentration camp slave labor in his factory, and he's basically, you know, I mean, he's trying to keep them safe.
Yeah, if you're on Schindler's List, you're not going to die in a gas chamber.
But they got to keep working at this factory, and they're making munitions, and at least in the movie, he keeps recalibrating the machine secretly so that the shells aren't good. The idea being, like, These people are, you're asking these people to make the bullets that are going to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
But Mr. Burns doesn't fall for that shit. And he probably used slave labor, too.
Your Schindler's List is pretty good.
I've heard.
They also stick with the continuity that Jay... So Jay's at dinner. I kind of wish Jay and... and Homer's stomachs actually talked to each other. That we got to hear the Snagglepuss voice that Jay's stomach has.
But there is some credit continuity in this scene at the dinner table. Jay does have two Pulitzers. The episode Eye on the Prize, he gets a Pulitzer in, I believe, the 70s or the 80s, and he gets another one in that episode for something. We don't actually hear the... Oh, wait, no. It's the movie stinks. Just don't go. We don't know what the first Pulitzer was
and
for.
And it highlighted why I like... Jay Sherman is a lot like Homer, with the exception of the respect of his peers.
Well, he is smart and not good at what he does.
He's a food monster, but he's also very smart and erudite.
He's an ugly, fat loser, but he's still different than Homer.
But boy, can he sing.
Yeah. also not a drunkard, too. It's also weird to be him showing off to the family that much, I think. Jay has the Maurice LaMarche belch, which we would hear later in the episode, but I think I feel so bad for Homer that Bart literally gives him Homer's award for best belch. It's like, oh, poor Homer.
The one thing he had.
Yeah, they give it away.
There's like a weird C-plot in this episode about Marge possibly leaving Homer for Jay. There's a lot going on.
Yes, there's...
I'm not saying it's a bad episode, I'm just saying it's kind of mixed up in what it wants to do.
It's pretty mangled, and I do like that, much like Artie Ziff, Jay Sherman is into Marge's sisters.
So then I said to Woody Allen, well, Camus can do, but Sartre is smartra.
So original.
Droll.
Yeah, well, Scooby-Doo can doo-doo, but Jimmy Carter is smarter.
Okay, Sherman, you're a movie expert, so tell us, who's gay?
Oh, I don't know. Harvey Fierstein.
No.
her incredulousness at Harvey Fierstein, the most gay person in the world.
I did not get that as a kid. He's in the only notable movie I can think he's in is Mrs. Doubtfire, but he's in the second season of Simpsons.
Independence Day, Chris.
And he's murdered in Independence Day by a giant fireball. But was he one of the first out actors?
He was quite out for a long time, and then he was, I think he was most famous at first for the eerie... He rose to fame on Broadway for the Torch Song Trilogy, which was one of the very few openly gay plays on Broadway at the time. But it was quite a big deal.
That's the joke of this, and it's still really funny. That's like, that's the one person everybody knows is gay. Yeah. No! No!
I remember there was people joking that when he was cast in a recent-ish production of Fiddler on the Roof, that they said... This has to be the first time he's ever played a straight man in anything.
So, Uncle Frank and Aunt Jack.
Homer tells Jay to tell Patty and Selma that MacGyver is gay, which is... They're still carrying the torch for MacGyver. MacGyver's been off the air for at least 3 years.
Yeah, that joke sucked.
They said MacGyver, not Richard Dean Anderson. It's a very important legal issue that they say MacGyver is gay. MacGyver.
It's an invention gone wrong.
Yes.
But
I can't reverse it.
Though I disagree with Jay. I prefer Camus to Sartre. I think that Camus has more emotion and humanism to his work, while I think Sartre is more clinical and removed.
Who wrote The Plague? Is that Camus?
Yes.
Okay, I like him.
Also, The Stranger is my favorite.
I want to knock all of your books out of your heads right now.
Albert Camus, The Stranger. You guys should read it.
This guy was just screaming about the Flintstones meet the Jetsons. We contain multitudes.
What about
people?
Eudora Welty? I mean,
if you guys really want to get into existentialism, I suggest Franz Kafka's work. He is my favorite existentialist, probably because he has the most father issues.
I like the Peanuts. It is my favorite existential cartoon in the universe.
It is. Yeah.
Why do we bother doing anything? Just ends in failure.
Sartre's most famous work, Jean-Paul Sartre's most famous work, I would say, is No Exit.
Yep.
Is his most famous, so check that out, which is Hell is Other People is the answer to that.
It's true. And Eudora Welty is a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist. I studied literature for a long time, but I never read her. But unfortunately, whenever I see her in the library or the bookstore, I think of that belch.
Yeah,
she's scarred forever.
Is it needlessly mean?
Well, the joke is that she is...
I just don't know anything about her personally.
She is a very thin Southern woman who was born in 1909.
Yeah.
So she was... The joke is to conjure an elderly woman belching at that level is funny.
It's funny.
It is a funny visual.
Jay is dating her, and Krusty dates her later.
Yeah, I just didn't know if she was like, you know, America's Rose or some shit like that.
No, but she...
I only checked to see if any of her books were made into movies. I suck at this kind of research.
I would think they just looked at a list of every Pulitzer Prize winner and just found the funniest one. They're like, well... Like when she did win a Pulitzer for her book in 1973.
The Optimist's Daughter. I wrote that part down.
Also, Eudora Welty is a funny name.
It's a funny name.
It's the funniest name they could pull.
And I'm on Homer's side, too. Jimmy Carter is better than Scooby-Doo.
And Scooby-Doo can doo-doo.
But that him doing Harvey Fierstein was only because John Lovitz played Harvey Fierstein on SNL in somewhat homophobic sketch now.
Was it the Harvey Fierstein show?
Yes. Yeah. Just want to be loved. Is that so rule?
You let closeted John Lovitz play whatever gay he likes on stage.
He's
got quite the young girlfriend.
Yes, does he?
Wife.
Many beautiful ladies.
I wear many beards.
He also owns a comedy store
now.
I think
that's over.
I
looked up. It might have ended in like Scandal.
Who knows? It's just so weird because it's like, you're not a stand-up. You're an actor. Dude,
I was there at Universal Studios when The Simpsons opened up. And yes, the John Lovitz Comedy Club. And it's like there's certain faces you don't want to plaster in LED lights like the size of two stories. And it's just like, could you have dressed him up a little bit? It's just like an open shirt, smile, 16 chins.
I haven't been to that one, but I have been to the Brad Garrett Comedy Club in Vegas.
It's very funny, Raymond.
They advertise just like Brad Garrett could drop in. You never know. Like, I'd
do all that stand up we known for.
Brad Garrett, yes. I like the animation of him hanging
I got
from
Diana
his
sighing.
Underwear, too. Sorry, Dave.
Bob John and Diana sighing.
Then we get another hot dog song, which lets John Lovitz sing, as he's so good at.
He needs to sing in every episode he's in.
Yeah.
Marge, do you respect my intelligence?
Yes!
Okay. Wait a minute. Why did it take you so long to say yes?
No reason.
Okay. Wait a minute. Are you humoring me?
Yes.
Okay. Wait a minute. That's bad. Look, I know I'm not witty like that critic guy, but does he know all the words to the Oscar Mayer song?
Oh, I wish I were an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is what I truly like to be. Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer wiener, everyone would be in love with me.
So, two things. One is a Al Jean and Mike Reese trademark. It is padding out the show with a joke that takes a long time. In this case, it's worth it. It's not floating heads around a character.
Yes.
Second thing, this is their second stab at the 1960s Wiener Wars.
That's true.
In the episode Lady Bouvier's Lover, we had the Armor Hot Dog song. In this episode, we have the Oscar Mayer Wiener song. And yes, they invented these songs to fight each other in the Wiener Wars of the 60s.
These were diss tracks.
Oh, well, my God. Kind of. It was like, we can make the better Wiener anthem, sir.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer Wiener. That is what I truly like to be. Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener, everyone would be in love with me. A big parade is so inspiring. Oh, I'm glad I'm not an Oscar Mayer Wiener.
What?
It's like Milhouse.
That is what I never want to be. Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener,
kids in trouble.
There would soon be nothing left of me. Oh, I love to be
forced conformity.
That's the 50s for you.
You didn't see this at home, everybody, but he was almost about to get lynched.
Yes.
Yep.
And that kid, he's okay now.
That kid's dead.
For daring to doubt being an Oscar Mayer
killed
Wiener.
By his hot dog choice.
But he was right. If he were an Oscar Mayer Wiener, he'd be eaten.
I've never seen anybody wish they wanted to be the product.
Yes.
And why do we know that? Was this song, Jingle, still going?
It was around in the 80s and 90s,
okay.
Too.
Yeah, well, I knew it because the Wienermobile returned in my childhood. My mom was a big fan of the Wienermobile.
Oh, yeah, the Wienermobile.
Oh,
and the Wiener Whistle.
I bet she was.
All right. Yeah, right.
My question is, where are the tough kids eating Armor hot dogs to get that kid's back, you know?
Yeah, that's true. They should have had his back.
He is one of the sissy kids who loves Armor hot dogs. They were right.
I'm now more of a Nathan's guy. Hebrew National.
Hell yeah, beef.
All beef, baby.
Because, you know, pork, you can't eat it, not even with a fork.
I eat fake hot dogs.
A great callback, you wussy. We'll talk about your rampant vegetarianism in the next episode.
Humorless.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's also when Homer cuts out a lock of Marge's hair, which really is a carpet sample. Like, it's a huge chunk of her hair.
So, in this episode, in Lisa's wedding, Homer eats an entire suckling pig. And there's a lock of Marge's hair featured as a plot point.
Yes.
A very minor plot point.
Yeah, that amount of hair actually reminds me of the hair running off of her body in Simpsons Excafragilistica Celadosha, you know.
Or when, I forget what episode it's in, where Homer is trimming the bushes and he cuts off a big chunk of Marge's hair. The front, yeah. No wonder I couldn't remember it.
They did more jokes about her hair back then. Then we get, I didn't collect that one, but you get a quick set of clips of the people auditioning to be Burns, and it is so critical.
Very critical. Like Shatner appears.
Simpsons
in his,
would never do a Shatner. Well,
in
they
his
actually
Star
have,
Trek
but,
outfit.
Yeah, but which one is that? Like Generations?
It,
or
it
something?
Looks like from one of the movies.
Yeah, one of the '80s movies.
It's the late movies ones, like
it's
the 4, 5, 6, because they had to get them as they could hide girdles better.
A great a great movie, by the way.
Yeah.
But this it somehow is the most '70s they ever looked, including the time they made a movie in the '70s.
Well, there's a reason they had to add belts to it because like they got older. They got older and fatter. And
it's
they
the, but
to
it's like
it.
The Santa frill stuff on the shoulders, that,
like piping or whatever.
Yeah, like to, pipe cleaners.
Well, when you
to
compare it.
It
to the suits for that at the then current Next Generation. Those were full body jumpsuits with clean lines. Like you
were
all
sexy in shape. People in there.
Yeah, you could not be fat in those. Mm-hmm. You had to be in good shape, or it would show.
Unless
any
you work
bulges.
Behind the bar, Whoopi.
The one thing that saves this. The one thing that saves this this little montage is when we're saying exactly.
Exactly.
That's another meme that might be just for me. I think
I love
of that all the time. Exactly.
And I like that it convinces Burns that he has to play himself, which is what he wanted to do. From
yes.
Me.
Yep.
The Hibbert Rocky Horror bit is a little odd, but I did like it as a kid just because it was right around when I discovered Rocky Horror through reruns on Comedy Central, which it is one of my favorite
musicals.
Dude,
I've still never seen it.
Really?
I've never seen it.
I used to play the soundtrack all the time.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, I love the idea of, I mean, Hibbert, like the squarest guy ever, being dressed up as Frankenfurter, and that they brought that joke back like 2 years ago?
No,
for adult Halloween, wasn't it?
I thought exactly, but he is. He's dressed in like almost like Sean Connery from Zardoz, but I think he's just a generic devil.
Oh, okay.
I thought someone was dressed as
it was
Hibbert.
It was he's dressed. He has on a red leather thong.
Right. No. So he's dressed as Zardoz, not as Frankenfurter.
It's just a generic devil.
I think they were all just supposed to be sexy.
But you've seen Hibbert's upper thigh more than once.
I mean, at the Do What You Feel festival, doesn't he snap Wiggum's undies? He's wearing very.
They're
like,
both no. That's in Krusty Gets Canceled.
Oh,
they're both wearing undies, as inspired by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I see.
But though
you were the times, Mo.
The only characters, the only costumes I remember from Adult Halloween is the couple's costume of the Van Houtens, where Luann. I say it wrong every time. Luann Van Houten, she's dressed as a squirrel, and Kirk is completely nude except for a giant acorn covering his genitals. And I was like, boy, that's really risque. Everybody sees your butt. All right, but then we get to see everybody's films, which I like all three of the. Oh,
so here's the
films
thing:
here.
the title parody has nothing to do with the actual movie.
Yeah.
They're completely unrelated in every case, which is pretty funny. Well, they can do like two jokes, I guess, two kind of movie parodies,
which is what they did on the show.
It feels like they burned off some shitty episode titles for later seasons.
On The Critic, they always thought it's always felt like they thought of the title of the movie first, and they're like, well, I guess we got to do a minute. A joke.
Oh, a Mad TV joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Help! Help, police!
Hey, I got problems of my own right now. Oh boy, this is gonna get worse before it gets better.
Next, we have Mo the bartender in Mo Better Booze.
Money gets you one more round. Drink it down, you stupid clown. Money gets you one more round. You're out on your ass. Whoa! Ah, my back!
Hans Mole Man Productions presents Man Getting Hit by Football.
This contest is over. Give that man the $10,000.
This isn't America's Funniest Home Videos.
But the ball... It's groin! Ah, it works at so many levels! Roll it again.
That's another line I hear all the time.
It works on so many levels.
Definitely never heard that until this episode.
So we should dig into the movie references. Diana, I think you should go take over
so
here.
So Bright Lights Beef Jerky.
Yes.
The first one's based on Bright Lights Big City. Starring Matthew J. Fox, yes.
I had never heard of this movie until now. I've heard the phrase Bright Lights Big City, but I just watched the trailer for the first time like yesterday. I'm like, oh, this was a movie. I had no idea.
Most Michael J. Fox movies are forgotten if they're not Back to the Future.
It seemed like a Bret Easton Ellis kind of story almost.
Yeah, I think it is. Mm-hmm. And then Mo Better Booze.
Oh, wait one second. I want to say that the actual movie feels like it's referencing Clerks in some way, where Clerks was the year before.
Wow.
This is a black and white convenience store story.
The Simpsons would have had, writers would have had to be at Sundance.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Maybe.
Black and white films filmed that cheaply, but I think more it was just... I think it was implying the only way Apu could make a film is by using his...
Yeah. Maybe
his
it was too late
security
for
security cameras. Yeah.
Or too early.
All right, so Mo Better Blues. The title's Mo Better Blues, the Spike Jones film.
Spike Lee.
God damn it. I always do that. Yes. Spike Lee joint.
It's the one everybody forgets about, In Between Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X. But it's got Wesley Snipes and Denzel Washington.
That is the music one of
it.
It is.
Right. And obviously the way Mo looks and the singing and dancing is Cabaret.
Yes. Right, and we have the clip.
Very Joel specifically Graves. the Money song.
You stupid clown?
Yes.
Money makes the world go round, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go round, that clinking, clanging sound can make the world go round.
So there you go.
I love that film. I love
great
that film
movie.
So much.
So it's, there's something about a man wearing a lot of rouge that's just off-putting.
Yeah, that it comes real close to kissing a woman,
especially
God,
on Mo.
So
he's clearly the Joel Grey. Which, by the way, Joel Grey only came out recently. It's like
what?
Yeah. Well, he's had heterosexual relationships before. He is the father of
Jennifer Grey
of Dirty Dancing.
Oh, I see.
So he had had women in his life before, even though everybody's like, dude, you're gay, but his coming out thing was basically him saying like, I now choose to live as a gay man.
It's
type
a spectrum.
Thing which he said before, it is a spectrum, but he says he's officially gay now. So
which
that's
is good, because the clip you just showed me is the gayest thing I've seen in any monitor in this room in a long time.
Cabaret is a very gay film. It's a very bi film. I don't want to do bi erasure on it, because the lead character in it really is like bi.
Copping using gay for camp, because that is like the fucking campiest thing I've excruciatingly campy thing I've
but
ever seen. I've not seen this movie.
But it is also about the rise of Nazism, too, and how it just kind of sneaks by.
Not in that clip.
Uh-huh. His song about the ape that's very much about anti-Semitism. And
anyway, so man getting hit by football.
Yeah, let's talk about.
I love the old timey piano leading into it, like it's a silent film.
Yes, yes.
Except it is. You hear his groaning.
Except for that little boink noise. I love
boink
that
noise is the best. It's not used at any other point in The Simpsons.
Yes. And I think America's Funniest Home Videos was inescapably like the number one show forever, even this time.
It.
Is it still on TV?
Yeah.
As AFV?
It's hosted by Alfonso Ribeiro.
Man. Yes.
Taking over for, Jesus, what's his name? Tom
Fugel?
Tom Bergeron.
Tom Bergeron.
And I have to come out here, speaking of Cabaret, I'll come out right now. America's Funniest Home Videos, it's like Facebook videos, the show. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's on every time I go to my parents' house. And like,
it predicted the internet.
It did.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It's funnier than almost any. It has a better laugh quotient than any show on television. I know no one respects it, and that's fine.
And some of our favorite MST3K writers finally got to make money by working on this
show.
It's
true. And I think it was popular, and what other network puts something on at 7 p.m.? Like, that show's been on at 7 p.m. for two decades, and I don't think Fox still puts anything on at 7 p.m.
One of the greatest.
Big Bang Theory in my town.
One of the most heartfelt and sincere opening songs ever. You're red, white, and blue.
The funny things you do.
Stories from your friends next door.
They held the mirror up to America, and we did not like what we saw.
I like that Barney can't remember he made a movie in the sentence after he said he made a movie.
Unfortunately, titled Pocahontas.
That joke sucks.
It
I don't
does
like
suck.
That
it's
joke.
Bad.
You can tell it was a rewrite, too. We mention this all the time on Talking Critic, how it's like Gene and Reese needed to just have more faith in their first draft, because every time they redo it, you're like, this joke can't be funnier than the one you replaced it with, because this is not funny. But anyway, yes, here's Barney's film.
My name is Barney Gumble. I'm 40, I'm single, and I drink. There's a line in Othello about a drinker. Now a sensible man, by and by a fool, presently a beast. That pretty well covers it.
A
It's brilliant. Savagely honest, tender. He has the soul of a poet.
You're very kind.
Excuse me, did something crawl down your throat and die?
It didn't die. My name is Barney, and I'm an alcoholic.
Mr. Gumball, this is a Girl Scout meeting.
Is it? Or is it that you girls can't admit you have a problem? Don't cry for me. I'm already dead.
That's the first time I recognized that was a bottle opening over the fin at the end of the movie.
I say that last line all the time.
That definitely got meme fight. I like that one a lot.
Yeah, one thing I noticed for the first time is that I remember in Boy Scouts in the Hood, they couldn't say Boy Scout. They had to say Junior Campers. But in this episode, they do say Girl Scouts, so maybe there was less of a fear of litigation or whatever.
Is the joke's not on the Girl Scouts?
Yeah, maybe. They're not making it look bad.
Yeah, they're not.
Barney is the bad one. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
And I like design wise, you could tell it was a church basement, which is where AA meetings often take place.
Improv sessions.
Yes. Well, we did our improv sessions in a newspaper.
In the hollowed out husk of the San Francisco Chronicle, which literally had a course to teach civilians how to use WordPress.
Yep.
In the Chronicle building.
It was amazing. Like,
somebody's got to do it.
That could not have been more salt than a wound.
We got to see the newspapers dying in front of us. But visually, it's very inspired by Kiwanis Kwatsi, among other, and Calvin Klein commercial. Yeah. Well, the time lapse of the clouds is very Kiwanis Kwatsi.
Kiwanis Kwatsi. Life out of balance.
And that though the music is from Madame Butterfly.
Yeah, that's Une Belle Dee, the famous aria from Puccini's Madame Butterfly.
Just about
and
to say
the
that.
The animation is beautiful. I think Susie Dieter said this is the proudest she's ever been of anything she's done.
Yeah.
At least in 2004 whenever DVDs came out.
Dude, they have every right to be. This shit rules, and you know it wasn't easy.
Now, it's fun to watch. It's really fun
elderly
to watch.
Barney, too, on it is just like... There's like a line on his neck, which you could say is a mistake, but it's like, no, maybe he put on a mask for this. Like, that was his makeup.
But you could tell they weren't confident enough to show the entire short. They have to cut away to Barney to have a joke and then continue with the very serious short.
They didn't have the balls to not have a joke for that long.
I think there's some groaner jokes in there saved by Danny Castellaneta's performance as Barney, as usual.
Can't admit you have a problem.
That joke sucks, but that line is amazing.
Also that he admits, like, oh, hey, something did crawl down my throat. It continues to live.
Great.
Whatever.
He sounds kind of... he sounds a little offended that you let that thing die. Yeah, no, it didn't.
It didn't die. He's a good owner of it. So... I also like in shows where they have to tell you that the audience either likes or doesn't like something just so you know it's supposed to be good. So everybody applauds. It's also a nice little low-key joke that Homer misses the movie but because he's getting a beer.
Yes.
He comes in holding a beer. And that's when we find out there's only one film left, which is also full of stuff. I cut the very beginning gag with Mexico just because I didn't want the clip to be like 90 seconds long. But I do love the gag that Burns... is celebrating that Mexico would... He's like, Mexico would celebrate me bringing jobs here and taking them away from American workers.
Yep.
And also, the intro is very... It's the overture to Ben-Hur. It's not... Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They said on the commentary, the title card is a parody of...
Agony in the Ecstasy?
Agony in the Ecstasy, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the title card is Total Agony in the Ecstasy, which is about Michelangelo. Wait.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Michelangelo.
It's about paint dropping into Charlton Heston's eyes.
Yeah. And, that Burns for All Seasons, obviously. Man for All Seasons, which is a great movie and everyone should watch.
Pure egotism.
Self-indulgent tripe.
I don't care what they say. I'm going to win this festival. Drink up, Judah Ben-Hur.
You truly are the King of Kings.
Excellent. Smithies, are they booing me?
No, they're saying Boo Earns. Boo Earns.
Yeah. Are you saying Boo or Boo Earns?
I was saying Boo Earns.
Another meme.
A line of the show number two.
All right, I'll give it through.
Come on, I think of that every day.
Real, that's...
That's the joke.
It could have just stopped with Smithers saying, they were saying Boo Earns, yes. But then yeah. Mole Man was inexplicably saying Boo Earns.
He really was.
Boo Earns.
I feel like I was remembered waiting to hate that joke, and just the tag at the end.
I love it all really so wonderful. Much that I was saying Boo Earns. Everyone says it all the time in my life. It is such a memeified thing. So that first, I did like the E.T. scene because they animate how alien Burns actually is.
Yeah,
when
he's like
show
standing
him
in the
walking
yeah.
around with his arms up in T-Rex style.
And so you love.
Yes. But secondly, then, yeah, we get kind of, it is a scene from Ben-Hur, though the line, I didn't get the clip from Ben-Hur because it really is just silent. Ben-Hur has been refused water. He's been turned into a slave. He's been refused water all day.
I just watched this movie.
And Christ gives him water.
Right. Not a plastic water bottle, though, yes. As it is in the movie.
That's great, yeah.
I love that extra
it's
thing.
A tiny little detail.
He meets Christ earlier in the movie.
Yep.
And I thought it was a reference to King of Kings, which has the distinction of being the only movie my father has ever bought himself on VHS. Mm-hmm. No idea why. Nah. It's not, even though that's the first movie to ever show Jesus Christ's face. Because it's still an over-shouldered shot in the sequence. And in an English-speaking U.S. movie,
and Ben-Hur,
they treated him very like Muhammad in all these billion movies about the fucking Bible. I love that I got to say fucking Bible in 2017. but I just watched Ben-Hur because it was on TCM, but also because how the fuck do you remake this movie?
I was going to say, we all forgot as a society that they remade
Ben-Hur. They remade Ben-Hur. It got its own Xbox game.
Technically, the Charlton Heston one's a remake.
It is.
Yeah.
But the movie, they've done it three times.
The end of the movie is Jesus H. Christ.
Yep.
How do you do that in 2017? Because that is the end of the film.
Well, they probably hope to market it to Christians and get
that
Christian.
They didn't.
That's really
stupid.
I'm positive they
excised
all that shit.
They should have at least. If you market it to Christians, then they feel it's their duty to see it to support righteous filmmaking.
Yeah, like Passion 2, Ben-Hur
exactly.
style.
That would have been great to see them destroying 4K copies of Ben-Hur.
But speaking of the Passion,
the Hestons, the Hartman doing Heston, truly you are the king.
Which
of
is
kings.
The only appearance Hartman
yes.
in this whole episode.
I was sure he did some other voice, and he did not. That
he
is
does
the
not.
Shortest appearance of Phil Hartman in any Simpsons episode.
Two things. There's a very uncomfortable moment on the commentary where Lovis is like,
I love it.
Hartman stole that impression from me. And then they're arguing about it. He's like, if I'm wrong, may he walk in the room right now.
May he walk in the room and deny it.
Yes. But the line is actually a misremembered line from the greatest story ever told.
Right.
It's John Wayne saying it, so let's hear it.
It is John Wayne's cameo.
Truly, this man was the Son of God.
Why would he feel that after just watching him die on the cross? He hasn't been resurrected yet.
That did it.
I get, well, God is making it rain because of...
greatest story ever told is not an especially good version of the Jesus story and all that, but...
You like the R-rated Mel Gibson cut?
Mostly because there's like distracting cameos like that. It's like there's a lot of, I mean, maybe they're less distracting now if you don't know who these people are. But I mean, when John Wayne walks up as dressed as a centurion and there's this big moment of like, he's on the cross and Father, why have you forsaken me? And then fucking John Wayne rolls up in freaking
like,
Roman gear. You're like, wait, what?
This is like the mad world of biblical epics.
Yes,
like, why are the three stooges stabbing Jesus?
Put me in a movie with Jesus or I'm going to get a new agent.
It would be like if George Clooney or Matt Damon just shows up in a film now that they weren't even advertised for.
Yeah, it'd be like, wait,
cameo.
What?
Yeah, they only do that on Jimmy Kimmel segments.
Well, and especially you're supposed to be feeling, I would think the filmmakers want you to be feeling a lot of things in that moment that aren't related to like, wow, that's John Wayne.
Yes.
They want you to be feeling the sacrifice of Christ for your soul.
Oh man, I liked Hondo. Let's go watch that, honey.
Laser Time Network is the king of Hondo references. We own that shit.
I only know because Al Bundy wanted to watch
Bundy,
Hondo.
I only watched it because, and it's like, it's okay, Wayne. It's like lesser Wayne. But
I don't remember which podcast, but I have a long story about fucking Hondo. Somewhere. Jesus.
My favorite Christ movie. Well,
oh my God, no.
I don't
know. Do you
know
how long we were running?
I have to say that for animation
fans. Let me
read
the Book of Matthew for everyone. Just a second.
I was more of a Luke man.
I was in a movie theater, and sometime this Christmas, they're going to sneak in a cheap CGI animated comedy star-studded all about the manger animals in the birth of Jesus.
Yep.
I've heard nothing about this, but it's called The Star, and I'm so fascinated.
Anyway, sorry, yes. Boo Earns.
Boo Earns, everyone.
I love, too, that Burns thinks that it would be fine to recast himself as Christ. He was Jesus Christ. But it seems like they're in a bit of a deadlock in the voting for this.
Well, I vote for Burns' movie.
Me too. Now let's get going. I got a date with Eudora Welty. Coming, Eudora.
Excellent. Bribing those two judges has paid off, just as it did during the Miss Teen America pageant.
How can you vote for Burns' movie?
Let's just say it moved me to a bigger house! Say the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet. Oh, dear.
Oh, God. I think of that line whenever someone is obviously bribed, like, oh, that moved him
to a bigger house!
I use that quite a bit, and if I'm not going to make any arguments, that's my favorite line of this episode that I forget every day is from this episode. No idea.
Can I have a new complaint? We never got to see Tommy Toon as Smithers.
Yeah! That's true. We totally even missed that, yes.
I was wondering, because there's a big cast list. Did you guys go through to pause the cast
list? No, I did not. I looked at a couple. It was just random names.
It wasn't a lot of jokes. People. Yeah, I looked at a list online.
All right.
But so yeah,
the four seasons of Arrested Development was that guy?
Yes, damn it. Lucille Ostero's brother. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Head of austerity, but he loves musicals. And the joke is that Tommy Toon is gay. Get it? He would be playing Smithers.
He was like in Smithers. Lots and lots of musicals.
I love Tommy Toon. He's great. Too. But also, yes, the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet. I think of that as anytime somebody fails to wink that they were paid off for something or that they have an ulterior motive. I've been seeing that a lot, too, of people saying, like, when they get a quote from, say, Mitch McConnell saying, well, if we don't vote for this, then we won't get to pick our Supreme Court justice, or we won't get to kill the ACA. And then they go like, you're saying the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet here, guys. You can at least hide this from us a little bit. And then Homer is just addicted with football and the growing.
Matt Groing.
Yes. And then we also get another critic stable making fun of Rex Reed, usually in a somewhat gay way.
The Rexall thermometer.
Yes. Yep. The implication that Rex Reed only is on the jury because he slept with the head of the film festival, which would imply he's sleeping with men, which is because Rex Reed is gay.
Really? There isn't a lot of women in power in the film industry?
I don't think so.
I think recent events have shown us no.
Though the commentary on this, too, is like, I learned very little about the making of this episode because John Lovitz is constantly calling Al Jean and Mike Reese gay. Just constantly saying,
everyone but me. That's how it deflects.
And there's a couple.
Hey, look over there. Your shoe's untied.
And there's a couple long stretches of silence where then you later hear Gene say, well, John was singing earlier, and that reminds me of when he sang when we recorded this. I was like, oh, they had to cut out him singing because, like, you can't sing on the commentary. We'd have to pay for it.
Yeah, or he's singing a song about Al Jean and Mike Reese being gay.
But so then Homer finally watches Barney's movie.
Barney's movie had heart, but football in the groin had a football in the groin.
Don't cry for me. I'm already dead.
Wow. I'll never drink another beer.
Beer here.
I'll take 10.
He learns nothing from that movie.
And I love that there's the baseball beer concession guy just wandering around
shouting
empty theater.
Yeah. If only. Jesus.
Well, it could be the same hot dog guy that's following him around in Round Springfield, the next episode
Maybe
of The Critic.
Put my kids to college.
That could be an early Alamo Draft House.
Though they don't shout beer here.
I said it's an early one. They had to work out the kinks.
Yeah, they duck around like magician's assistants.
I also think about that, though, with reviewing, too. Like, well, this had this, but football on the ground. At football in the groin. But yes, they then announced the winner. Well, though, first we get a Itchy and Scratchy short, which
I love it. I love the bomb children.
The implication that not only did Scratchy have sex with a pile of dynamite, but that it was able to procreate. Like, that he was able. And I guess the four funerals would be Scratchy, Itchy, and his two bomb children would have to explode eventually, thus making it four funerals and a wedding.
One wedding. It works out.
As the title. The math checks out here,
and it's
folks.
A parody of a famous movie.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
Patton.
Patton, of course.
Yeah.
That's why I was in front of a giant flag the whole time.
The winner of the grand prize, Barney Gumble.
Homie, you voted for the right movie. I'm glad you were on the jury.
You know something, Marge? It's not that tough being a film critic.
I've learned I have a gift to share with the world. From now on, there'll be a new Barnard Gumble. Hardworking, clean, and sober.
Congratulations, Barney, and enjoy your grand prize, a lifetime supply of Duff beer.
Ah, just took it to my veins!
And they dutifully do that.
Yeah, they're ready for it. Okay, another line that is a meme. Hook it to my veins whenever like a new game comes out or a new like podcast comes out or anything you really want to get into and leave the world for.
If you want it, you're just like, just hook it to my veins.
Although I think Barney went through his lifetime supply. The next season, we see the Barney guarding job.
Yeah, you know, wait,
because he's going to suck all the beer out of most taps.
Clearly that lifetime supply. But by the way, don't put beer in your veins. You will die.
You will die. And all those bubbles?
Yes. Air in your veins kills you, as Homer would reveal in the Ritalin episode.
Brother's Little Helper?
Yes. Yeah. Wait, there was only air in my syringe. Just took it to my veins. Also, I just love the film, The Cricket. The film Cricket.
It's not hard being a film cricket.
Then they say their farewells, where Bart represents Matt Groening again in this episode to say that this is definitely the last time this ever happens.
Goodbye, Mr. Sherman. If I ever play Carnegie Hall, I'll give you a call.
And if you ever want to visit my show...
Nah, we're not going to be doing that.
Jay, I hope you tell your New York friends that people in small towns aren't quite as dumb as they think.
Marge, look, this has spring snakes inside, but the suckers will think it's beer nuts. Beer nuts.
So?
Well, it was a lovely festival. The best movie won, and Mr. Burns found there are some awards that can't be bought.
And the Oscar goes to...
I've got to win this one. I bribed everyone in Hollywood.
George Z. Scott in Man Getting Hit by Football.
My groin!
That is great. That's Maurice LaMarche, too.
Ruining a fine actor for generations.
Well, yep. I looked into George C. Scott a little bit, but he was, you know, he had that waning career of everybody in Hollywood where he's just doing, like, TV movies and small...
Yeah. He's also doing the thing where he died in movies a lot. Like, in Angus, he plays his grandfather in Angus and dies in the middle of it. Which...
It's far too long to play on this show, but everyone look up the Paul F. Tompkins bit about spring snakes in peanut brittle cans.
Peanut brittle.
Amazing. He dissects the logic of that joke.
Canned peanut brittle, my favorite treat, which is sold all the time in big aluminum cans.
Oh, it's so great. Please look it up.
It's beautiful. Yeah. But George C. Scott is one of America's greatest actors. Like
Ebenezer Scrooge
is great. Yes, as Buck Turgidson.
Most people might know him. I feel like 12 Angry Men is showed a lot in schools, and I think they've chosen to show the remake where he's like the Jack Warden role, the angry guy. Like, he's fucking guilty. Let's get out of here. Got tickets to the game.
He's the last guy to be in changed his mind.
But Dr. Strangelove, he got the Oscar for Patton. I think he's the first person to refuse an Oscar. He's like, everybody was great. Fuck off.
And I didn't know he did a sequel film 16 years later about Patton's last years.
Oh, yes. Like a made-for-TV movie,
He was great, and he would be alive.
He's the captain on the Titanic in 1996 is Titanic, not 1997.
Wrong ship.
And yes, he would live... Just barely. He would live till 1999. Wow. George C. Scott, but yes, he's so fucking funny in Dr. Strangelove. He's so great.
Star of the movie They Might Be Giants.
Yes.
That's one of my favorite bands.
I didn't know that. So yeah, this episode, we were talking, Henry and I, before the show. We both thought going into this will probably be a subpar episode because it has kind of a reputation. But no, it's great. The plot is totally non-existent, but we pulled out like eight things that are everyday memes you see on Twitter every day on this episode.
Just perfect lines.
Yeah.
It's just perfect, nice little, so many good jokes.
Yeah, it's just a little bit rough around the edges, but thoroughly enjoyable and has clearly stood the test of time as something Simpsons fans love.
Yeah, I think mentally you clip out the weak jokes in here, like the Death Wish joke.
Pocahontas.
There are some lame stuff in here, but there's so many rando things that you forget is related to Jay Sherman showing up. Almost, I think none of the things we remember as memeified have anything to do with Jay Sherman.
No, they were very careful. He gets no really good lines.
For real.
No.
Yeah. He gets that Rex Reed line. He gets to sing Oscar. He gets to sing. And then just he languidly brags about his Oscars. I think the closest thing to a good line is him saying, Camus can do, but Sartre is smartre.
Yeah.
And it's just a clever thing if you think about that huge showcase, because 5 minutes later, he's in his own show, and audiences are a little more comfortable.
You're ready to watch him leave The Simpsons and then travel to his own show.
I'm not sure if we'll ever see something like that again.
And the Spring Snakes joke. That was, I just noticed in this viewing that it's clearly an animation mistake that Marge is blinking opposite. Whenever her eyes are supposed to be open, they should be closed and reverse in the shot, because
her eyes are closed for a long time during that joke.
So clearly they messed up, but couldn't do a research for it. Yeah. It didn't really matter. The joke, I think, it actually makes it funnier to see Marge react in no way to Homer freaking out
or
at Spring Snake.
Closing her eyes in shame, like, you know, please stop this, Homer.
A good episode with transcendent moments, but also, not totally on Mac Rating side, but it's definitely made for commercial reasons, but I think they made the best out of that situation.
Yep, exactly.
So thank you so much for joining us on this extra long Talking Simpsons episode. Thank you, Diana, for coming by and being on it as part of our Talking Critic crew. We really appreciate it. And as for me, I've been your host, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Retronauts. It's a classic gaming podcast every Monday, and occasionally we have a bonus episode on Friday. That's at Retronauts.com, or look for Retronauts in your podcast device. I think you'll like it if you like me, and if you don't like me, start working on yourself. That's all I have to say. Henry, please tell everybody about our lovely Patreon and maybe a surprise announcement.
Yes! Well, first off, if you liked all this talk about The Critic, you should listen to the Talking Critic show that we do with Diana and also Michael Raparez, Mr. Diana Goodman, as I like to call him. where we go through every episode of The Critic in the same manner that we did this. So if this discussion of The Critic on The Simpsons really inspired you to look at that more, go to sign up at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. $5 a month gets you access to that, as well as a ton of awesome things, including some interviews, and we'll be adding more interviews to that soon. We got some cool stuff brewing, but
I'm so excited.
Won't announce it until it's official, but I will tell you what is official.
Wait.
Mark your calendars.
It's a big deal, everybody. Don't turn this off.
Big deal. Do not turn this off. January 28th, 2018. Talking Simpsons Live. We have our own live panel at SF Sketchfest here in San Francisco in the Bay Area. We are going to be doing a live podcast recording as part of the awesome San Francisco Sketch Festival. I love SF Sketchfest. I've probably given them thousands of dollars in ticket money.
If anything, they owe us.
Yes, exactly.
You better be dead or in jail.
So, yeah, we're going to be in the third week of it, the last weekend, January 28th. We will be at the Piano Fight Bar doing a live recording of it. So if you live in the Bay Area, if you can come and see it, we will be doing...
Really need the seats. Just a couple films. It can't just be our girlfriends.
I believe it is free. The admission is free, though there might be a...
Do we get a cut?
I'm happy for just the exposure.
It's a cool bar with great food. It's an awesome venue.
And again, I just love SF Sketchfest and so awesome to be part of it.
You're honored.
Yes, very, very honored. So mark your calendars. We'll have more details on exactly what we're going to be doing at it there, but it is a live podcast recording January 28th, 2018.
Next year. I'm not plugging anything after that.
Well, Diana, come on.
Well, if you like me butting in with all my stupid movie stuff, then you probably like me on Twitter at ListenateNerd, or you can hear me every week on 302010, where we look back 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago at that exact week. We're finishing up 1987, 1997, 2007. We've got the first billion-dollar movie of all time coming up.
Oh, God.
Hey. Oh, wow.
We all have to rewatch
that. My heart will go on.
It's going to be fun. So, yeah, 302010, the words, .net.
And you may have heard a highlight clip on one of these shows, but Diana... I don't think we've ever made Diana laugh as hard as we did in our Worst Critics Ever episode in the one-star Amazon review of Citizen Kane.
I thought I was going to die.
You almost had to leave the room.
I was about to just go time out.
Pass
out. I'm done.
Whoever that guy is, he's my favorite writer of the year.
I've never heard Citizen Kane compared to the movie he compares it to. Listen to the episode to find out.
It was so whack and boring, and the dudes all wore the same suits and looked the same. That's on the episode.
I guess the lighting was okay.
The Worst Critics, where I tried to find the worst critical reaction to some of the most well-regarded things of all time. And if you like cartoons, we are going to have a shitload of awesome stuff coming up on Laser Time, including something I believe I teased a long time ago that both Bob and Hank are involved in, well as some additional stuff. But, you know, it'll be around for the holidays, so check it out.
I hope we made no comments about stars who have since been exposed as bad people.
Talked a lot of shit about Tex Avery.
My love of Harvey Weinstein. That could possibly not bite me in the ass. Thank you for listening, folks. We'll see you next week with Lisa's Wedding, A Trip to the Far Off Year of 2010. We'll see you then.
Infotainment.